This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I loved meeting you. I was so impressed. One may argue that I'm a liberal Democrat. That might not be inaccurate. And sitting there with you and listening to you, I just wished that our political discourse was more that you were more the mainstream of our political discourse. I thought it was interesting. You even talked about religion in a way, and I'm a fairly agnostic individual. And in a way that I found extremely interesting, in a way that I could connect to you and the way that you saw and felt about the world.
Very generous, very kind.
But it was
Clinton, Tarantino for movies, and it was me for politics.
Exactly,
so let's just see that, Jordan.
I owe everything.
See that?
I owe everything to you, Governor.
All right. So, Jordan, you know, I think everybody in America was stunned with the developments at Mar-a-Lago yesterday. Nobody knew what to think about it. What to conclude? I mean, what was your reaction when you heard about it?
Well, I mean, I've heard some conservatives say that liberals are out here celebrating this FBI raid, which I find a little offensive. I popped one bottle of champagne and a couple caviar bumps, and that's it. Because you have to mark the illusion, or at least the potential promise of accountability with something. But that was it. Other than that, it felt like a pretty regular night for me. How about you?
Well, I mean, you know, I kind of look at these things as they would affect anybody. And 30 or 40 FBI agents going, I don't know if you have you ever been, have you ever heard of that kind of a raid happening on other people? I'm aware of it. It happened at other times. And, you know, you got to have one hell of a justification to go into somebody's home. And what I find interesting is, and I've had a number of my friends, my liberal friends, I don't kind of think my friends are liberal, but they'll say I'm more liberal, and they're very concerned about this, mm-hmm. about what's behind it. And we should all be concerned about it. I don't know. We just got to see what they find. I mean, the inclination, I think, for all of us is try to kind of explain this or jump to a conclusion. We don't know. We don't have enough information. But what I will say is there better have some stuff there, because this is serious, serious stuff.
It's of course it is serious. You know, my assumption is they know. I mean, it has to be signed off on with thorough evidence to make a choice like this. And so I'm hoping there's evidence to do this. Although I think as someone who sits back and hears this happen, I mean, we've been privy to so much evidence in many different forms that the idea that there's enough evidence of Donald Trump that he is withholding information, so much so that he's not going to give it up and that FBI agents have to go and take it. Yeah, I buy it. Literally that morning, I was reading a story about and seeing pictures of him flushing documents down a toilet. The man is accused of eating documents he doesn't want to share with people after sitting through also January 6th hearings of just consistent rule breaking. And so I understand the cautious element of like, you have to, this must be pretty serious to take that. My guess is it's pretty serious, because I feel like we've been watching the actions of a very serious
look,
person for quite some time.
As a liberal, you have to be concerned about the power of government to invade your home. I mean, you know, I don't know what we have here. I mean, they say that a federal judge has to sign off on it. There's a rumor going around that it was some magistrate in Florida. I don't know what the facts are, but this is really, really serious. And as you know, I'm not a fan of this guy, but I am a fan of a protection against search and seizure that is not really legitimate. I just don't know what to say about it, but I'm concerned about it. And I think there's a lot of people, regardless of philosophy, are very, very concerned about this. The other thing I would tell you is...
I'm curious about that knee-jerk response, because I get it. Of course, you don't want a government overstep in situations like this, but we've been watching the actions of somebody who has been breaking the law, not cooperating with governmental agencies, throwing them under the buses for 5 years, literally taunting actions.
Yeah, but what are you talking about?
Well, I just feel like the idea that Donald Trump, this is under the premise that Donald Trump has broken federal laws and will not give over information, so much so that they're afraid they're going to lose that information. That, to me, is not a crazy premise whatsoever. I think it should be handled carefully, and I really hope that the Justice Department has.
What if it's these archives? Mm-hmm. I mean, what if it's that? I mean, you go into a former president's house because he's sitting on paper for 2.5 years and you didn't get it? I mean, I don't know. I'm just raising the issue because I don't know what's going to come from this. But I'm concerned when I see government officials doing things really aggressively. I get concerned about it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it isn't right. It doesn't mean that it won't bear out to be right. But this is exactly the concern that people have about big government and my rights. And so, and that's not limited to just somebody who's a conservative. The other thing I wanted to say, Jordan, is no matter who they are, there's some bad people that you say, okay, good, but I never like to see bad things happen to people. I mean, I just don't like to see it. Now, some people, you know, get what they deserve, you know, and the justice system meets it out. But there's not a Republican. I know Liz Cheney, there's not been a Republican. I've been against this guy for 5 years, okay? I don't hate this guy. I just don't agree with him. I don't like what he's done to dividing our country. But I don't ever root for anybody to have bad things happen to him.
But what is it? Accountability is not a bad thing happening.
No, justice.
Why have a Justice Department if, like, I don't, Donald Trump, you know what he was doing? He was, like, hanging out in New York City trying to push lies to all of his underlings at the exact same time that a Justice Department went inside his house and took something that belonged to them. To me, you're an empathetic man, Governor Kasich, but you don't need to feel bad for Donald Trump on this.
What I will tell you is they better hope that they have something there. They just better hope they've got something there, because this is going to make things much worse and much more. I'm not even sure it'll divide us as much as one might think, because I think that people who are civil libertarians who fight, you know, to have peoples who, you know, have been imprisoned for things that they never done, they go and they fight to get them released at the Innocence Project or whatever. All these people are very worried about the power of institutions against normal folks. And I know you look, but this is just that principle. That's all I'm saying.
I this situation, I don't see a normal folk, and I see criminal activity across the board. I had an interesting experience this weekend. I went to a Trump rally in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and I was shocked by it. I've been to so many of these, and the purpose of this one for The Daily Show was to look at these primaries. He's endorsing these MAGA candidates, and I wanted to talk to people on the ground, like, what is the Republican Party looking like from a MAGA perspective? And so we went there with an assumption that we would talk about some of the issues. We talk about how they felt about Roe v. Wade, what they cared about, and what have you. And I will tell you, this thing spiraled into conspiracy town immediately. almost every single person I talked to, we're not just talking about not believing the election, Dominion voting machines, that was there. JFK Jr., most people were talking about JFK Jr. is alive, multiple people talking about him being vice president. We had a woman who introduced the idea of gematria to me, and she travels around the nation in a group called Negative 48, which believes that John F. Kennedy is coming back and actually was at D-Day to meet Donald Trump. These are bonkers accusations. And I've seen this at rallies before. Like, obviously, we talk to people, and it would be a fringe subset of the people we would talk to would reach for these wild ideas. The idea that Donald Trump is in charge of the military right now.
Right.
This is so commonplace that it's not as if we're looking to find this. This was almost the entirety of the people that we talked to. I fear people's brains are melting. They're being codified in this way that was at once fringe, and now I'm talking to what appear to be normal grandmas in Waukesha, Wisconsin, who are telling me that John F. Kennedy Jr. is alive and he's going to be the vice president of the United States. And I look at them and it makes me fear for this country. This idea that like these at one point might have been the moderates, and now they're trafficking in conspiracy theories because what else is there to do?
Wow. Wow, I don't know what to even...
It's scary.
It's almost like with some of these folks, it's cult-like, you know? And there was a interesting thing, a story I read, sad thing I read, about a guy who was working his way out of the cult, whatever cult you're in, and how hard it is, you know, how the families are in so much pain because somebody that they love and care for has found themselves into a cult, and how hard it is to get out of it. And once you get out of it, how hard it is to stay out of it. And, you know, it's interesting because it can become an addiction. And as you know, we have a guest that's coming on today that's going to talk about the power of addiction and has tried to do something in his work in the entertainment industry to talk about this issue. And maybe to some degree they're connected, you know, the addiction to opiates, the addiction to a cult. Maybe that's something he might have an opinion on. But why don't we get to him?
Yes, well,
tell us who he is.
Governor, I'm very jealous of this person. This person is acclaimed in so many different areas, prolific award-winning film and television actor, writer, director, producer. He wrote and produced films like The Hunger Games, The Butler, Game Change, Recount, and co-created the longtime hit series Empire. And he's now the creator of the Emmy-nominated series Dopesick, starring Michael Keaton, Rosario Dawson, and Peter Sarsgaard. The first season is now streaming on Hulu. We're pleased to welcome Danny Strong. Hey, Danny.
Hello. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for coming on. Are you listening to this? You are an actor, writer, director, producer. Is your writer brain working as you're hearing these stories, trying to find, one, a clean narrative to tell this story, and two, empathetic characters that maybe we can understand and empathize with?
You know, it's so, it feels like there's so much insanity all over the place nonstop that it's hard to sometimes take it all in and make sense of it. You know, you just talking about the conspiracy theories, right? JFK Jr. is vice president. And for me, I ask myself, well, is that just super fringe? Is that just the people that are showing up, or even a small sect of the people showing up at the rallies that you're covering? Or is that truly the mainstream thought of an entire political party? I just don't know the answer to that. I know that it's much more interesting to cover the people that say JFK Jr. is still alive, right? Because it's crazy, and we know it's not true. But at the end of the day, you know, for me and what I do in my own work is I try to find sort of the essential truth of a situation, like what's really happening, not so much the sensationalized version of it, but you know, and not the news version at the end of the day, because I think the news is trying to sell clicks and papers and is going for the most dramatic kind of stories they can, as opposed to what the essential truth is of a situation. And so for me, I'm always looking for that, you know, what's really happening and how much of this is real versus how much of it is trumped up to be entertainment.
Yeah. What'd you think of the raid, Danny? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I think that I thought, you know, it's not, it's, you want to say it's shocking, but it's not like they raided Tom Hanks's house or Mother Teresa's house. I mean, this is someone who has been investigated many times, multiple grand juries. There was a New York City investigation that the DA didn't pursue. And then the two prosecutors that were in charge of it came out furious with the New York DA, saying there should have been a prosecution, that we could have found the former president guilty of charges. So it's not as if that I just don't see how anyone could be completely surprised by this raid when this is just a pattern that we've seen multiple times, and it's happening in Georgia. There's a grand jury right now, and then simultaneously the January 6th committee, there's nonstop discussion whether he's going to be indicted or not. So you know, it was surprising that something actually happened to people that follow that follow the travails, the legal troubles of Donald Trump. But I don't see how you could be shocked that this was something that occurred only in the context of, wow, it seems like someone finally pulled the trigger on something.
Interesting take. Before we move on, I wanted to tell you, I had a chance to spend some time with JFK Jr., actually, Jordan. Yeah, it was really something. They had selected me to be one of the most fascinating people in politics. And when he ran George Magazine, it was after they put me, I don't know if I was on the cover or whatever, but the thing went under right after they named me. So, but the thing that was interesting is I went in there with a friend of mine who almost passed out when he met JFK Jr., really handsome man, but, you know, charismatic, the whole thing. And, you know, JFK says, John says, you know, would you guys like some water, some coffee or whatever? I go in, I do the interview. We come out and he goes down the elevator. He says, here, let me help you out to the street. And we go down the elevator. I'll never forget when the elevator door opened, there were all these people in the lobby and you could hear this collective gasp like, oh, you know, they couldn't believe they saw him. And he walked us to the car and I said to him, man, is this what your life is like all the time? And he said, you know, my mother told me when I was a young boy that I had to expect this and that I had to prepare myself to be nice to everyone I ever met. And it was true. And it was, he was a perfect gentleman and terrific guy and really, really interesting. I'm glad I had that opportunity to meet him. And Michael Keaton, by the way, Danny, my Uncle George was his guidance counselor in Pittsburgh. You know, he's a Pittsburgh boy. And I said to my uncle, Michael Keaton, because he's the star of your show, Dope Sick, which is, you know, we want to hear a lot about. And I said, how did you like Michael Keaton, Uncle George? He said, he was nothing but a troublemaker. He turned out to be Michael Keaton, right? So I said, Uncle George, I think you judged him the wrong way. He's really done pretty well for himself. But he's really a remarkable actor, right? And he's the big star of Dope Sick. And
yeah, remarkable actor, a great guy, too. I mean, literally the most down-to-earth, normal movie star I think I've ever met. He's just his persona of sort of this regular guy, a great guy, someone who's really funny. That really is who he is.
I'm fascinated by Dope Sick. I will, full disclosure, when I first heard about this, I heard this is a great show. It's good. I did not want to watch it. Show about the opioid crisis. I'm like, this seems dark. It is dark. It goes to uncomfortable places for sure. But when I finally started, my parents watched it. Were like, you have to watch Dope Sick. You have to watch Dope Sick. I'm like, I'm watching the news all day. I need something fun. Give me some bake-offs. It's so compelling the way you're able to weave in this story that one personalizes this experience for so many people, specifically in Appalachia, and kind of puts a face to the Sackler family. I want to talk about sort of the dynamics of telling a story like that and how you go about that. But to start with, like, why did you want to put a spotlight on the opioid crisis?
Well, first off, huge thank you to your parents. I owe them.
They're smart.
Anyone who gets me a viewer is A-okay with me. So please send them my gratitude. The story was brought to me by John Goldwyn, who's really a successful producer, great guy. And the Sacklers had been sort of a major news story because of a New Yorker article by Patrick Braden Keith that tied them in as sort of the masterminds of the origin of the opioid crisis. That was essentially the thesis of this story. This is the family behind how this all occurred. And he said, you know, do you want to write and direct a movie about them? And so I started to research them. There had been multiple books written besides this article. And I could not believe what had happened and how much was already in the public record at this point, because Purdue Pharma had pled guilty in 2007 to felony misbranding. And there was a statement of facts of the things they had pled guilty to. And it was horrific in my mind what they had pled guilty to. And then the fact that Purdue was able to keep selling and ended up selling more aggressively post this guilty settlement, pleading guilty, was offensive, shocking. The whole story just offended my sense of justice on every single level. And then simultaneously, I was able to figure out a way into the story that I thought could overcome your perception of it, which was, by the way, Hollywood's perception when I went and pitched the story to all the studios, which was that this would be too dark and unappealing. And that was to do it as an investigative thriller through the eyes of these prosecutors that brought the case, through the eye of a DEA agent who was trying to actively stop Purdue in 2000, 2001, 2002. And by telling those stories, I thought, oh, you could tell the origin of the opioid crisis in a way that was dynamic, entertaining, as like I said, somewhat of a mystery thriller with investigations. And then simultaneously, I thought, okay, well, I got to tell the story of addiction and the story of the victims of this crisis as well. And so that was my approach into it, was this multi-layer, multi-character journey. I was very much inspired by the movie Traffic and the narrative structure of the movie Traffic as a way in. And I thought, wow, you could have a really dynamic piece, but also a piece that could in many ways, in my mind, be the trial that Purdue Pharma, which was micromanaged by the Sackler family, never had. Because I thought, if you could show what this company did, if people could see it with their own eyes and intercut that with their victims, it could be really, really powerful, really shocking, really upsetting, and hopefully land what the hell happened for the historical record. So it was very ambitious what I was up to dramatically, thematically, and the goal of the piece. But I thought it could be great and just went for it.
We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
And now back to the show.
You know, guys, when I was first elected in 2010, these ladies, when I was campaigning, they had talked to me. But when I was elected, right before I was sworn in, they came with pictures of their kids. Kids had played football, cheerleaders, and they. I said, these pictures, they said, yes, these are our children who we lost. And you promised you'd do something about this, and we want you to. And I mean, we all cried. And then we went to war. And we had these things, Danny, called pill mills, where people it would be like going through a McDonald's to get French fries. They were lining up in cars to get these drugs from these doctors. Ultimately, Mike DeWine, who's now governor, was the attorney general, asked me to not do anything too quickly, but that he would prosecute. And we prosecuted people. And then we imposed, we got to the business of how you get these opiates. And we used our medical board and our pharmacy board to impose restrictions, tightening the whole thing up to the point where I think we were the leader in the country as to how you get these, how long you get them, how long can you stay on them. And we saw a significant drop in these pills and in addictions. I can't tell you where it is today, but if you use and move beyond that and you talk about the hospitals where people go get treated and then they can't release them because if they release them, they'll end up having to come back again. And they got to figure out how to get them off and how to get them rehab. And these poor hospitals in places like Kentucky, you know, they're barely making it. In West Virginia, it is such an unbelievable challenge problem. And I'm really glad that you shed the light on this thing in a way in which people could understand it. And maybe it will keep some people, Danny, from actually, when they have a surgery, you know, when they go get their wisdom teeth out or something, they don't have to take these drugs, right? Isn't that part of what you did here, is that you're trying to impact public policy? Is that part of your purpose and to become an activist?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I talked about this sort of the legal justice element of the show, but there was also a part of the show which was to redefine sort of our nature and understanding of an opioid addiction. And one of the reasons why Purdue and so many other distributors have been so successful at keeping this massive amount of pills, in the public, at hospitals and these pill mills, is because of this narrative that the real criminals are, quote, the addicts. They're the ones that have a moral failing, and they're the ones that are responsible for this spike in addiction and abuse, when in fact the pills were sold to them as safe. And people could get addicted in sometimes 3 days' time. Easily within 2 weeks, you could become addicted. And that's what happened here, was that the rate of people that went from painkillers to heroin went up 80%.
Yeah.
This isn't just some random incident of all of a sudden heroin rates skyrocketed. No, it started because of prescription pain medication that was sold to patients and doctors and hospitals as non-addictive. Less than 1% got addicted. So it was a con. It was a shell game. And that simple big lie exploded addiction rates all over the country and created what we're living through, which is now the fourth wave of the opioid crisis. But it all started in 1996. And so the fact that the victims of the crisis were blamed as the reasoning behind it was another element that was deeply angering to me.
That's like human trafficking, you know, where I got in the middle of that as well, Jordan, where they were actually blaming the women when the pimps were and the Johns were able to get away. We changed the laws in Ohio to go out, and you wouldn't believe some of the stupidity that came out of the mouths of at least one legislator, but we ended up changing that law. And when you and Danny, when you think about the opiate addiction, think the families, and then the moms and the dads can get on to heroin, and the kids are left with nothing. You've got kids raising kids. And I had children, young students who were still in high school, come to see me, and they were raising their brothers and sisters. And they were like, I asked this one girl, what do you think about your future? She said, I can't think about a future. I mean, it made you cry. And yet we took action. But Danny, there was too much that went on for too long where people, and we still have a problem out here with the growth of fentanyl now. I mean, people that are dying who think they can buy some street drugs and it's laced with fentanyl, and the next thing you know, they're dead. And that might be I don't know how you follow up on this, but you've done a big, great public service, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Governor. Thank you for your actions that you took as governor. They were absolutely effective. And anyone that pushed the ball forward on this instead of backwards, and there were so many people in government and both parties that in fact actively worked against stemming, opioid distribution. It's enraging when you look at the facts, especially when you get into 2008 to 2016, when already we were in a crisis. 2016, the DEA is hobbled in a bipartisan vote. It's really an upsetting, shocking story. But it goes to the very heart, I think, of the dark side of American capitalism, where moneyed interests are able to get government entities that are supposed to protect people from these moneyed interests. And in fact, the moneyed interests are able to have their way and commit acts that are in fact harmful to so many people in the country.
I want to talk about how you approach this. We're talking about real people who are actually affected, but you're also blending fiction into the storytelling. And a lot of the stories you choose to write are based in reality. Recount, Game Change, Dope Sick, The Butler. I think Hunger Games is a documentary from the future, if I don't recall.
The future Buchanan administration. We'll talk about that later.
Okay, good. Yes, yeah, I want more details. I need a sequel just to know what my kid's going to grow up in. But I'm curious, in telling a story like Dope Sick, like you said, you're also balancing telling a story in the Hollywood market, which has to be marketable, consumable. You have to fictionalize part of it so we can understand the storytelling. How much of a story do you think can be fictionalized or heightened for entertainment without diminishing the gravity of that story? And how do you balance that or approach that?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of what I did, it wasn't difficult at all to walk that line, because the fictionalization was creating composite characters with the goal of just getting more anecdotes, more true life anecdotes into the story. So that was the goal of, so I didn't have to follow one exact person's journey. I could have a composite character and use multiple anecdotes from so many different people. And one of the reasons why I decided to adopt that technique is through the course of my research, there were just so many common stories, so many archetypes of addiction that kept coming up. And they were sort of different archetypes of different socioeconomic status, but nonetheless, they would follow certain patterns. And I thought, okay, if I can just create these characters, I could get more of these true life stories into it. And thus I felt like it would be a more universal truth than if I was just following the journey of one exact person. You know, in the case of Michael Keaton's role, there's anecdotes of him from three different doctors, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors that went on the journey he went through. But I was able to use just these incredibly powerful true life stories from multiple people and put them into one character. And I thought it was a powerful way to do it.
How much of this, you were working from a book and from the author, forgive me.
Beth Macy. Lovely woman. Yeah, I love her.
You're working with Beth Macy and from her book, as you're compiling these anecdotes and building characters off of it, are you doing the research on top of that? Are you out continuing to build and pull stories? Like, how do you fill a story like that out?
Yeah, Beth's book, which is a gorgeous book, it's really powerful, was not the only source for the show whatsoever. I mean, there were so many books written about it that covered so many different facets. And then Beth wanted to be in the writer's room and wanted to be on staff in a full-time way. And I thought, wow, so we're going to have an expert on staff. Terrific. And we kept reporting all through the writing process and then all through production, which is something I haven't done before, where new information is coming to us and Justice Department documents are being leaked to us. We've got new people that want to talk on background. And I'm literally rewriting scenes sometimes a day before we're shooting them.
This is really something.
Yeah.
This is really amazing, you know?
And that's, Beth was a big part of gathering all that information. I call this, Woodward and Bernstein, where she was Woodward and I was Bernstein's incompetent cousin Sid, you know? Just like trying to figure this out. But it was a pretty thrilling experience as far as that, the fact-finding goes.
Hey, Danny, so you know what? What's so interesting in, you know, your journey to hanging out with Quentin Tarantino when you're like, 10, to all of a sudden these people are bringing all these things to you, right? I mean, this was brought to you for your being able to be able to write and make this. Are there some other area? And look, you're as Jordan said, you have so many different things that you've been connected to. But when you look at what you did with opioids and with Dope Sick, are there some other social causes that you think perhaps you could take on? You know, human trafficking is a very, and you ever want to know about that, you get a hold of me, because we are big time in terms of being experts on that out here in our state. But how do you do this by maintaining, you know, not either right or left, but a certain neutrality where you're just reporting a story so that you can continue to be effective. I think it'd be probably pretty easy for you to kind of drop off and go to the right or to the left. But maintaining neutrality and credibility with all the other work you're doing, when you bring this these things that are true stories or based on truth, this could be powerful for you in the long term, couldn't it?
Yeah, you know, I'm definitely, I don't view myself as neutral, but I'm trying to be fair, accurate. Yeah. I'm not interested in partisan politics in what I do. I feel like partisan politics is
boring,
we get plenty of that.
Boring.
Well, we get it all on
crap.
Cable news.
Yes.
And,
that's what I tell Jordan all the time.
You know?
He wants to talk about politics. I said, I'm sick of it, aren't you?
We don't necessarily need that. I mean, no one needs me to spout off, right, what I believe politically, although I've made two highly political films, Recount and Game Change, which were, by the way, people in both parties came out and said were fair, accurate. People in both parties came out and attacked it. Both movies. And I was like, well, I think we're doing pretty good here. If I'm pissing off people in both parties and I'm having people in both parties saying it's accurate. And that's what I'm guided by, right? Which is A, the truth, but then also what I'm trying to say about it. What is the theme? What is the bird's eye view that turns it into, and I hope this doesn't sound pretentious, but a piece of art? You know, how is this story worthy of being turned into a piece of drama, not just a retelling of facts or a simple, you know, a partisan jab at something. You know, that's not what I'm into. As far as, you know, human trafficking, I tried to sell a project about human trafficking and I wasn't able to. And I had what I thought was a powerful way into it, but that's how hard it is to get these projects made. You know,
maybe we should talk, Danny. Maybe we should talk because there are some unbelievable stories. And I know, I think I could help you to figure out an angle where you could do the same kind of stuff, where you could have one character, but you could have multiple stories being told. Jordan,
what is this?
I'm sorry.
I would be the one sucking up trying to make deals here.
Here is
the governor's
the
got
Danny's
his back
philosophy.
End already.
No. Danny's philosophy is you write what is your passion. You don't write something to sell. My passion throughout my life and in politics is I follow my passion. I'm not interested in some salesman BS. You know?
You've been a human trafficker for decades now.
I'm telling you, when you hear the stories, and my wife has been very involved in helping them. I mean, these are people, Jordan, who, I mean, they're basically slaves. And how they get out of it. And we actually had a point where the highway patrol was active in trying to make sure that when they stopped, particularly truck drivers, they'd search the whole truck to see who was being transported. You wouldn't believe all the stories. And I think they're pretty compelling. But, you know, then again, I'm not a Hollywood writer, but maybe I should be. Maybe I should be.
Governor, why not?
Why not? That's right.
Give it a go.
I'm sorry. I'm just so pumped up listening to how he is able to use art in such a positive or descriptive way that turns out being positive to change lives. It's fantastic.
Well,
Danny,
thank you,
Governor. Curious, off of this, actually, I'm curious, the idea of, like, not to get into the Hollywood of it all, but I do think, like, functionally there is a business right here. And I think part of this narrative is who gets to tell these stories and what are the stories that are told. Human trafficking, for example, like you've had the ability to sell shows and to tell stories that are in the political spectrum, which are harder shows to sell.
100%.
You also co-created Empire, which, and you are, if you're not watching, you are a white straight man writing a show that is predominantly known as an important show within African-American culture. And I'm curious, as somebody who's had successes in Hollywood and moving forward in this, like how you navigate that, or what are your stories to tell? I've been in some of these pitch sessions and oftentimes what you lead with is, why are you the one who's telling this story? Why are you telling this? Are you affected by this? Specifically, do you have a personal story within that? It feels like, not to diminish your connections to caring about these topics, but you've had the freedom to talk about experiences that are outside your own. And I wonder how you've been able to navigate that.
Well, it's you know, look, it's become much more of an issue in the last few years, which is who can tell what stories. to me, it's the sort of that question is the opposite of what how I've lived my life and what I believe art is. I think that any artist should be able to tell any story. And that's and you know, the key to my own work as a storyteller has been one word, which is imagination, right? That's it. I use my imagination. Yeah, I use my research as well. I combine them and then I tell stories I'm excited about. And so I don't think any artist should be told what story they can or can't tell. I know that's not a popular opinion right now, but I just fundamentally disagree with it. And that's how I feel. Now, at the same time, there are, you know, you talk about the different stories I've been able to tell. You should see the list of stories that were rejected that I tried. I mean, it's literally so many more pitches I've taken out, so many scripts I've written that weren't made. It's not as if it was every one of these things has just happened. In fact, it's more the opposite. And for various reasons, these were the projects that made it through that impossible, you know, Sisyphus climb, pushing the boulder up the hill, where the boulder actually got up the hill this one time. So it's a lot of failure. It's a lot of challenges. And for various reasons, you know, these projects ultimately did get made, and some of it is extremely calculated. Some of it is lucky. Some of it is just seeing the opportunity and jamming it through. And, you know, in the case of Dope Sick, it was, I didn't care. I was just going to do this and until I could get it made or didn't get it made. And it ultimately, it almost didn't happen. The company I wrote it for originally loved it, but decided not to make it for their various reasons. And then someone stepped in, Dana Walden, who's now head of Disney Television. And I think, you know, this one of the reasons why is because she looked at the script and said, I just think it's great. And gave it to Hulu and said, hey, you guys take a look. I think it's great. And then Hulu stepped up and in 2 days greenlit it. Right. So a lot of credit is owed to Hulu for stepping up and telling a story that isn't the kind of story that Hollywood normally gets made. And one of the things I'm so happy about with the success of the show, there's a lot of things I'm really happy about with the success of the show. Mostly, I mean, it's sort of endless, the list, but I'm really glad that Hulu took this very expensive gamble and that it paid off for them. And that hopefully that can inspire other networks to step up and say, hey, look, you know, tough subject matter can be successful if done a certain way. So it's all of it's hard and difficult, but you know, at the end of the day, I'm just driven by what I'm passionate about, what I'm excited about, and what I think could be really good. You know, it's one thing to have a subject that is a really important subject. It's another thing to turn it into a piece that someone actually wants to sit through. Like your bias against Dope Sick, Jordan, is so common. And the only reason why you ended up overcoming it is because people said to you, no, it's great. You got to watch it. So you're like, okay, I'll watch it, you know? And if you didn't feel that way about it after one or two episodes, you would have turned it off, right? So you've got to figure out a way into these pieces that people can really love it.
You know, you had what 17 million or something that watched the session of the end of Empire, I think, with some enormous number of people that watched. Now, you know, I've been caught up watching that show Succession.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that there's such a similarity, right, between, yeah, I mean, do you feel a little ripped off that
so there's some jokes made when Succession first aired to me about it. I thought Succession's brilliant. I really love the show. So if we inspired it in any way,
there's nobody on there you can like, though, you know, Danny.
Well, I actually think, you know, Succession came from the Murdoch story, right? So the story of children trying to take over a family empire. I certainly didn't create that with Empire, and you know, Empire was inspired by Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. And his three sons, you know, Richard, Lionheart, and John and James, right? And so they, did I get those right? I sure, no, Jeffrey. Jeffrey and John, sorry. So
you better believe he's listening. So
yeah,
better.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to do an angry tweet by him. These stories are they're you know, and then there's King Lear, which is The Wine in Winter is a King Lear story. So it kind of goes on and on and on.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Could I ask one more, Jordan, here about this? You know, when you're talking about these movies and stories and everything, and I was in Chicago and happened to put on Harry Potter. I've not seen all the shows, but I'm watching that. And then, you know, Lord of the Rings, we just were talking about that the other day. How do these people create this stuff? You know, how can they create entire new worlds? I mean, have you met people like that who you look at and say, boy, I mean, it's a whole new world, right? That they come up with. It's amazing to me.
I can't do it. That's not my, you know.
Yes, you can. Come on, Governor. That's an offensive question. A successful Danny Strong, writer of 2 Hunger Games movies. How do you, these people who write these stories in the fantasy world, have you ever met one of those people? Do you know how they do it? You know how it's done. It's creativity, drugs, probably.
Imagination. Well, you know, look at the Hunger Games, right? Suzanne Collins, she's the mastermind behind those books. The movies are very, very close to the books. You know, I don't view that as a great artistic triumph of my own. I view it as Suzanne Collins' artistic triumph, and I tried to help, you know, help translate it with other people to the screen. So I agree with you, Governor. I think, you know, Tolkien and J.K. Rowling and their talent as artists is staggering. But you know, there's only a few of them that have the impact. You know, there are many, you look at young adult books, and there are many world building stories and books that have come out, but few of them have caught fire the way the three books that we've just discussed have. I mean, it's an incredible achievement. Harry Potter in particular, I think those books are, it's modern mythology in a way that it just affects us to our very core in such a powerful way.
I want to steal some of your tricks. So I want to talk a little bit about process. I'm working on a project right now, a writing project, and the difficulty I keep having in the early pilot stages is the balance of imagination and creativity with a schedule and getting up and writing. My schedule is all over the place, but I'm wondering how you approach having something that is both regimented so you can get pages out, but also something early on in a creative process that needs your brain to wander to put things together, that has to find inspiration from something else, but is also sitting in front of an internet and Twitter and things that are pulling your brain away. How do you give yourself space to wander and discover and yet still get pages out? Do you have a trick for that or a schedule for that?
Yeah, Twitter's great because it's so warm and kind and wonderful and just so much wonderful content on there. It just fills your heart with joy. Yeah. I'm on Twitter. I try to get it. I'm like, I got to stop because I'm getting too angry. I think that the key is consistency, and it's literally just showing up. And in 5-6 days a week, you know, I used to do 7 days a week for years, and I have a very wonderful life partner who demands, she's like, you got to take Sundays off. You're driving me crazy, you know? So it's real. And the good news is you don't have to spend 8 hours a day doing it. You know, 2 hours, 2 solid hours is enough if you're doing it consistently every day. And I don't believe in inspiration. I believe you just have to show up. And then once you show up and start working, and it takes me usually an hour to start every day. I wish I could start faster because then I'd have more of my day, right? But I'm spending an hour returning emails, surfing the internet a little bit, going on the Twitter machine, getting angry. And then I'm like, okay, I got to start working. But once you get a few hours in, and for me, it's really 3 to 4 hours of actual writing, then what happens is your brain works on it throughout the day without you even knowing it. So then when you go to the next day, you've solved some things or you've come up with some new ideas from yesterday that you've come up with subconsciously. Those ideas usually come to me when I first wake up in the morning, whatever my brain has worked out for the day before. And now I've got new things, new ideas that I'm working with. But those new ideas the next day, they don't happen if you don't show up the day before. So it would build upon itself. And then all of a sudden, 10 days later, you're like, wow, I got 40 pages. You know, what seemed impossible, now you've got 40 pages and you're really off to the races. So 2 to 3 solid hours of actually doing it 5 days a week is I believe what it takes to really get something done. And now, you know, I've been writing for 25 years now. So it's there's no struggle showing up. But every day there's the struggle of, you know, all right, stop returning emails, get to work, you know, get to work. But I do, because I'm there. What else am I going to do? I'm not going to not do it. You know, there's only so many hours in a day you could screw around on the internet, I hope. But that's it. That's my process. And it's not really magical. It's very pragmatic.
It sounds like you're kind to yourself. It's interesting because I feel like it's so easy for your head to get in the way and judge your lack of productivity with emails or any of that kind of stuff. Have you been able to train your mind to let that be your process in a way that you're not?
Well, that's what it is. That's what it is. It's part of the process is spending an hour returning emails every morning. So I literally, and I return all my emails every morning, right? And part of it just gets my brain going because I'm typing, you're writing, it's sort of like a little bit of a warm up for me. I will say that you said something that was pretty spot on, which is the self-defeating, the negative element of your brain that says what you're doing is no good. I call it your inner Iago, who's there to sabotage you. And so much of my artistic life is spent trying to tame my Iago. And I've got all sorts of mind tricks I'm basically playing with myself. And one of them, which I'll share with you, is that I outline pretty extensively. And then when I write my first draft, I don't read a single word of it until I'm done. So I literally write straight through. I don't look at a word, because if I start to read scenes, that could spiral me into a negative headspace, which isn't going to help me. So then all of a sudden, 3 to 4 weeks have gone by. It's been fun because I haven't read anything to put me in a down mood. And then I've got 130, 140. One time I had 170 pages. That's a problem because it's got to be close to 120. We'll figure it out later. And then I go through the process of then slowly editing it. And those first week or so of that can be pretty negative, right? But I'm ready for it. And I've already got so many pages written that I'm just prepared to know that this could get a little negative, but I'm going to work through that. And then all of a sudden, it's as if I've done 2 drafts in 7 weeks because of that process.
Sounds like our podcast. You know, we have to work through all this. Jordan, what are you working on? Tell us about your project. I want to know. What is it?
I can't. It's very top secret.
Come on. This is where, you know what? The last time you wanted me to tell you how much I paid for a haircut. Now I want to know about this project you're working on, and you just are mum's the word, huh? Is it secret?
I feel like, one, it's probably not an announced thing, it's not to be hyped up, but also not a thing that once you start talking about a thing before it's fully even a thing, then now you've ruined the thing and now there's weird expectations on the thing. And now I already know you're going to try to get in there and try to co-write this thing. I've seen how you...
No, I just want to be in it.
You want to be in it? You want to be a writer and
now,
an actor?
Danny,
you think it's this
Danny,
easy?
Let me just say, I always want to do everything. But Danny, you know what? To some degree, doesn't this just kind of come to you? I mean, you can't force it. I mean, and you say it's kind of like perspiration, not so much inspiration. But doesn't this just kind of come to you? You can see it in your mind. That's kind of the way I look at people who are songwriters, people who write. You know, I've written 5 books, you know, and they come to me what I want to do. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, Jordan. I mean, I don't know if you ever, I know you read coloring books, but I'll send you some of my books. But you know, things come to you about what, and I've got an idea in my head about what I want to do with the next book if I do it. The problem with writing books is then you have to go out and sell them and you have to deal with publishers. And I'd rather publish. Oh, what an industry. What a terrible industry. But the fact is that I feel that most things kind of come to you. You don't have to force them. They come. One thing leads to another, though.
Well, things will come, but I have to sit down every day and write them down or nothing's coming eventually. You know, and I think that you're a perfect example. You've written 5 books. There's a process there, and there's someone who does it and gets it done. And I think that you know, we're rewarded with these thoughts and these ideas. And for, you know, I'm sort of a a firm believer in sort of the Jungian collective conscious, right? That our brain is a computer chip and there's all this information in it, and then our conscious mind gets in the way of all of these ideas with our daily struggles. But when you sit down and you write every day, you start to peel that back. And that's where these ideas start to come in. I didn't mean to get so philosophical on you guys, but for me, that's how I view it.
That's
what sitting down every day does. And another thing I do is I meditate either 5 or 10 minutes every day before I do my writing session. And days that I forget to meditate, which happens usually once or twice a week, sometimes it doesn't flow quite as easy, which has made me think that, oh, this meditation thing, I think it actually works. So it's all part of just trying to let go and get into the page. But that's just not going to happen if I'm not showing up every day and doing it.
Now, if we're telling a story with this podcast, we can't let details just go without any kind of them being addressed. And the governor mentioned something early in this podcast was your 10-year-old relationship with Quentin Tarantino, which could you expound on that offhanded comment the governor said to set this up? What is that story there?
Yeah, so Quentin Tarantino very famously was a video store clerk at a place called Video Archives, and Video Archives was in my hometown, was my video store as a kid. How crazy is that? And not only that, but I was into adult movies as a kid, and by adult movies, Governor, I don't mean pornography.
I mean rated R
movies. I just didn't want the governor to think ill will of me as a child. So I would go to the video store. And sure enough, I was 10, 11, but I looked like I was 7 or 8. And I had this film knowledge that Quentin Tarantino loved. And he's the ultimate film nerd, right? So I just started going in there and I would spend half hour, sometimes an hour and a half just talking to him. And I was in there so much, they called me Little Quentin. And they'd say, Little Quentin's here. And then he'd recommend all these crazy movies that, you know, most 10, 11-year-olds don't watch. And I have to say that no one has been happier for me in my writing career than Quentin Tarantino. I mean, he just loves it and has been so supportive. He likes to say, thank God I did something with my life, because if Little Quentin was successful and I wasn't, I would have blown my brains out. That is the punchline he's used a few times.
What about you were a fan, I guess one of your favorite movies or favorite shows or projects is Alfred Hitchcock, right?
Yeah, I was a Tell Hitchcock fan, especially
I love
during
Alfred
those
Hitchcock.
Tarantino years. Yeah. They're amazing. It's sort of fascinating how Hitchcock was viewed for a great deal of his professional life as sort of, you know, a commercial, not like a hack, but he wasn't respected in an artistic sense. And then all of a sudden, I think it was Truffaut wrote an article and did a series of interviews sort of redefining Hitchcock as one of the great artists of cinema. And all of a sudden, he was redefined with the respect of the artistry that truly was exhibited in his films. And, you know, some of them are they're just incredible. My personal favorite is Rear Window.
It's such a great movie.
It's unbelievable. And movie after movie after movie. But I, you know, the Hitchcock, those were definitely movies that I was watching during my Video Archives Tarantino apprenticeship, for sure.
As you look at, you know, as somebody who's clearly, you know, born and raised in this film industry with a love for cinema, but also the ability to tell stories that matter. Where as a fan, what do you look to now? What gets you excited? What are the stories that you're impressed with how they're being told?
You know, it's there's so many different things. I mean, it changes weekly. my sort of favorite show over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months was the Lakers show, Winning Time. I just loved it. I just loved it. I thought it was incredibly well told, incredibly well shot. The acting was amazing. And I grew up in LA with all those guys as mythological heroes. So to see the story behind them, I just loved. I was actually disappointed they didn't get more Emmy nominations. I felt like they deserved a lot, particularly the actor that plays Magic Johnson. I think that performance is just so incredible. And to find an actor to play Magic Johnson and for him to be so good
he's from my small 1400 person college, Kalamazoo College.
Well, he's amazing in the show. So that's sort of my recent favorite is that. And I love documentary. I really love true stories as an audience member, which is why I think I write so many of them. But I write fiction too. I just get more true stories made than I do fiction. A great side note of some fiction work getting made. Yeah.
It's what's amazing to me about what's happened with streaming is it's just unleashed an avenue for creative people to do remarkable things. It's such a great, great thing. And hopefully it's going to get better and better and better.
Yeah, and unfortunately I have to go because I have a meeting right now, but let me finish on the I feel bad because this was great. Can I come back?
I didn't throw you out of my house when you were at my home, Danny.
That's right.
I mean, what if I would have said, I got to go now, get out.
Can I tell real quickly? So met Governor Kasich. I went to the governor's mansion with Joe Klein, the journalist, when he was traveling all through Ohio, and he would have different people join him for a few days of the trip. And so on the 2 days I joined, was one of the days was his interview with Governor Kasich. And I loved meeting you. I was so impressed. One may argue that I'm a liberal Democrat. That might not be inaccurate. And sitting there with you and listening to you, I just wished that our political discourse was more that you were more of the mainstream of our political discourse. I thought it was interesting. You even talked about religion in a way, and I'm a fairly agnostic individual, and in a way that I found extremely interesting, in a way that I could connect to you and the way that you saw
That's
and felt
really
about the
very
world.
Very generous, very kind.
But it was
Clinton, Tarantino for movies, and it was me for politics.
Exactly,
so let's just
exactly.
See that, Jordan.
I owe everything.
See that?
I owe everything to you, Governor.
You're such, I'll tell you, Danny, you are such a likable and positive and good man. I'm so,
thank you so
glad
much.
That you could be with us, and hopefully our paths will cross again. It's you're great.
Well, thank you, and it was great being here with you guys. When I heard about this podcast, I'm like, oh, I got to do that. That's fantastic. both your work is just terrific, and together it's a pretty great combo. So keep it up, and hopefully, like you said, our paths will cross again. And I need to hear some of these stories you were talking about, Governor. So
get ready, you're gonna get some some pages from the governor in the next couple days. So
absolutely.
Well, Danny,
all right,
thank
guys.
You.
Thanks so much.
This is the best. Watch the Emmy-nominated Hulu original series, Dopesick. It's fantastic. It's now streaming.
Follow the advice of Jordan's parents and please watch the show.
Mark and Betsy, don't lead anybody astray. Hey, everybody. Jordan here, your favorite host of the Kasich Klepper podcast. Thank you for listening this far. If you like what you hear, click like or thumbs up or whatever icon signifies a positive reaction. We love your ratings. We love your thoughts. Reach out to us on social media. Let us know what you want us to talk about, because I'm tired of answering the governor's questions and I just prefer to answer yours. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Kasich and Klepper is a production of Trefort Media, hosted and executive produced by John Kasich and Jordan Klepper. Trefort Media's executive producers are Kelly Garner, Lisa Ammerman, and Matthew Kugler. Line producer is Oscar Guido. Associate producer, Lee Albanese. Audio direction by Tom Monahan, head of audio for Trefort, with production and editing by Maxwell Carney. Sound editing by Abigail Sullivan. Talent booking by Blythe Asher. With additional production help from Tim Schauer, Haley Mandelberg, Lindsay Whistler, Colin Motel, and Anastasia Ibrahim. This podcast is powered by Acast.